unbelievable bands. Human Revolution, Diane Patterson's going to be there, my good friend. Sasha Rowe's going to be there. And I am the heart note speaker there. This will be my first time out speaking in my spiritual persona. You can find information on that event if you're interested in cruising up there on the CollapseNet website. Just go to the Founders Corner, and then there's a link right there from the homepage. It'll take you there, and I'm really looking forward to this. This has been an amazing time that I've been passing here for the last 7 weeks since I left CollapseNet. I have done nothing but pray, meditate, and play with my dog and tend my crops. I have 1,600 square feet under cultivation, 10 fruit trees, and a walnut tree. And I don't think I've been happier in my whole life. And that is possible, even at times like this. And at times like this, I decided to pick one story which pretty much summarizes how everything else is going in the world, whether you look at it from an economic standpoint, you know, financial standpoint, military, foreign policy, peak oil, environmental degradation. But the story I picked will be on the world news desk at CollapseNet tomorrow. This is from the Japan Times today. Temperature climbing and number four reactors pool after cooling system knocked out. Kyoto. The cooling system of the spent fuel pool in reactor four at the Fukushima number one plant automatically suspended operations Saturday, and the water temperature is starting to rise, Tokyo Electric Power Company said. The utility has been unable to activate a backup cooling system for the pool since operations halted at around 6:25 a.m. and is looking into the causes, TEPCO officials said later in the day. The pool's water temperature stood at around 31 degrees Celsius when the cooling system ceased functioning and was increasing by 0.26 degrees per hour late Saturday afternoon, according to the officials. If TEPCO remains unable to start up the system or its backup, the temperature could reach 65 degrees by Tuesday morning, the maximum limit specified by safety regulations. All important safety regulations there. No leaking of contaminated water from the reactor has been detected so far. The number four reactor's cooling system previously shut down on June 4th. And now, we talked about, I think it was last week, that the roof is now gone above the spent fuel pool, which is teetering on these, you know, spindly, broken, weakened supports, and there's no way to approach the reactor. The radiation in reactor one is at an all-time high. That was new this week. And the radiation from reactor two is so strong that it disables any robots that they send in to work on it. So that's the way everything is working in the world. And environmentally, it's very tragic as well. They're in New York tonight. They're seeing the smoke from the wildfires in Colorado. A biblical drought is ravaging from Texas through Mexico and Central America, and climatological collapse is in full swing. And by any number of standards over the last several months, we have crossed multiple tipping points of no return, which has changed the way a great many people that I hang out with and have known over the years look at things. So tonight, I really wanted to bring back, he's like a really good friend, and like the worse the shit gets out there, the more I seem to smile whenever I think of James Howard Kunstler. We have traveled many miles together. We met almost a decade ago, I believe it was. We were in Endo Suburbia in 2003 together with Matt Simmons, and we have walked the road. Jim is an amazing author. He writes brilliantly, and his website, by the way, is Kunstler.com, called Clusterfuck Nation. Yeah, you got that right, Jim. He's the author of The Long Emergency, World Made by Hand, an unbelievable book, The Big Slide and The Witch of Hebron. It's really good to have Jim back tonight, and I will say this about James Howard Kunstler. It's a much better world because he's in it, but not much. No offense, Jim. Welcome back to the Lifeboat Hour.
Well, thanks. That's good enough.
I mean, we all do our little parts to make the world better, but things are pretty clustered out there, aren't they?
Well, times are getting very interesting, and you sort of wonder how things are going to look in, you know, at the end of the summer. It's going to be kind of I think America's going to be looking kind of bedraggled. One thing I'm trying to do is persuade young people to think about going down to Charlotte, North Carolina, and Tampa, Florida, where the Democratic and Republican nominating conventions are going to be held, and to register their unhappiness about the way our political system is working. And I think that's a sort of legitimate thing to do. We did it back in the 1960s, and now it's time to start agitating again, I think, in a demonstrable, visible way.
I've had a number of guests on roughly since April when I had a major epiphany, and I looked around, and people like Peter Joseph had one, and apparently Dimitri also has had one. We have to bring Dimitri Orlov back, but what do you think has been significant over the last 3 or 4 months? Has anything really hit you between the eyes that's changed the tone, tenor of the world we live in?
Well, I can't say that I have had any epiphanies. We had a very weird winter. We had no snow up here in the Northeast at all, and that was pretty peculiar. The European banking meltdown has been interesting, but nothing really spectacular. I think that, you know, that we couldn't have predicted. Mm-hmm. Basically, you know, they're sort of buying time on the installment plan a month at a time over there.
And, you know, it's going to be to be more like a week at a time now, but, you know, you're right. Yes. I'm sorry. Go on.
I don't know. I called my previous book The Long Emergency for a reason, because I thought that this would be going on for quite a while, mm-hmm. and that it would be a long, agonizing, painful ordeal. So I'm not all that surprised that it's turned out that way.
Mm-hmm.
And it still is. I mean, it's a protracted situation. And, you know, there's a lot of inertia out there in our culture and in our economy. And I think it's going to take an awful lot to sort of shove it over the edge. And then once it goes over the edge, it'll probably be very hard to, you really have to stay out of its way.
What do you see that's promising or encouraging out there?
I don't see any sign that the American public is getting any more clued into the real set of problems that we face. You know, the energy predicament, mm-hmm. and the related wealth predicament, if we can call it that. It's really all of a piece, but I suppose you could make a distinction between money, capital, and wealth. But the net effect of this is that there's simply going to be fewer financial resources for us to do the things that we had hoped that we were going to do. You know, to begin consciously and deliberately fashioning some kind of a post-oil economy whatever the next economy might be. Instead, it looks like circumstances are just going to drag us kicking and screaming into that future.
I have kind of concluded, based on my analysis, that even if all 7 billion of us woke up tomorrow and said, yes, we got to get on all this stuff right, that even now, we now lack the resources, the time, or the skill to rectify so many things that are out of control. Do you think that's possible?
No, I think it's in the nature of things being out of control that you can't control them. but what you can do, and what we are doing, is pretending that we can control them.
Yes.
You know, that's what the banking fiasco is about. It really amounts to little more as a practical matter than just the application of large doses of accounting fraud on a continuing basis. And, you know, you apply enough accounting fraud, and then it looks like you have a solvent financial system. Sooner or later, reality does require, you know, reality, there's a relationship between reality and the truth,
mm-hmm.
Which is to say, a story that comports with what's really happening. And I think reality is very uncomfortable with a continuous diet of stories that are not consistent with what's going on. So you can only do that for so long, but we've managed to do it because there's just so much inertia in the system that we've been able to do it. And
I have been sensing, and this is why the more time goes by, the more your book, World Made by Hand, means to me, because it was a book in which you couldn't help it. Your intense love for this really messed up species revealed itself. But it is a book which gave me great hope about there's a line from the Starman, I think it was, Jeff Bridges, you human beings are at your best when things are worst. Right? And I'm personally experiencing seeing the best come out of people that are close to me.
But are you there on your farm by yourself, or are you in some kind of intentional community, or what?
Well, for now, I have the 2.5 acres to myself. I have 1,600 feet in cultivation, square feet in cultivation, 10 fruit trees, and a walnut tree, and it's like a real hilly place. So, yeah, no, I'm doing that all by hand right now.
I moved to a new place in November, after sitting out the housing bubble for about 6 years. And I bought a place in a little factory village in Washington County, New York, which is about 15 miles from the Vermont border. And I got 3 acres, and I planted a whole bunch of fruit trees and berry bushes, and created a rather large garden on the other side of the house. And it's been very satisfying to do that.
Mm-hmm.
However, I've been, this is very ironic. I don't think that you actually know I have a new book coming out.
Tell us about it.
In fact, the official publication date is tomorrow, and it's kind of an odd coincidence. But the book is called Too Much Magic, and the subtitle is Wishful Thinking, Technology, and the Fate of the Nation. And one of the major themes of the book, obviously, is that, this whole idea that we're sitting around waiting for Santa Claus to come up with a rescue remedy so we can keep running Walt Disney World and suburbia and the U.S. military and Walmart.
Yes.
And, of course, that's not likely to happen. And so the whole wishful thinking process is really doing a lot of damage to us. But another part of the book are the diminishing returns of technology. And by that, I pretty much mean the way technology bites back. And so I am now in the process of getting bitten by technology. I had a hip replacement in 2003. And I was feeling kind of shitty for the last year and a half. And I really couldn't figure out what was wrong with me. And my doctors were not really, the medical system being what it was, they weren't paying much attention, and I couldn't really get them to pay attention. Anyway, I finally figured it out and got blood tests and realized that I have cobalt and chromium poisoning from my hip implant.
Wow.
I have a metal-on-metal hip implant, and I got it during the time when they were introducing them, pretty much. They were giving them to somewhat younger patients who were expected to be pretty active and probably live with the implants for maybe 20 or 30 years. So the idea was that they'd last a long time. But they had no idea what the blowback would be. And the blowback is that, you have this metal-on-metal bearing in your leg, and it's grinding away at it, as it rotates year after year, and it's shedding ions into your system. And so I've got this accumulation of cobalt and chromium, and it's basically been poisoning me. So I have to have this thing removed in probably in August. I'm going to have what they call a revision surgery. In the meantime, I've been getting chelation therapy, which is, a chemical treatment to sort of drag the metals out of your body and direct them out through your kidneys and other organs, And it's been very interesting. You know, I mean, I've been feeling like I've been poisoned for, you know, for months and months and months. And so my direct experience with the diminishing returns of technology has been pretty vivid.
That's tough news, first of all. Give us the title of the book again, Jim.
Too Much Magic, Wishful Thinking, Technology, and the Fate of the Nation. It's published by the Atlantic Monthly Press.
Oh, good.
And it's available at all the usual spots. But I would encourage you, if you have a local independent bookseller, to try to support them if you can.
Sure.
Are you in a town that actually has any kind of life to it?
We have amazing life to it. Sebastopol is about 1,600 people. We're an hour north of San Francisco and maybe 30 minutes away from Santa Rosa. Mm-hmm. And we have amazing nightlife, club life. I've been hanging quite heavily with many of the local musicians. Matter of fact, I'm in a project with one. Tammy Gosnell is going to be on in a couple of weeks. She's a rock star.
And you're a rock and roller yourself, are you not?
I'm a singer-songwriter, yes, sir. And it looks like she and I are going to be going down to sing at the Ron Paul Fest in Tampa right before the convention.
Oh, goody.
I'm taking your advice there. And we are at a nightclub at the end of the world, so that's a perfect segue for our song tonight. And I was looking around today, and it was just a beautiful day, and I've had a beautiful 7 weeks doing a lot of healing. And so I thought about, it's been a long time since we played Avalanche and Earthquake all the way through. This is my signature song. We opened the show with it. Here's the whole thing.
Yeah.
White Trash. That was Doug Lewis on the guitar. He and I wrote the song together. We had Phil Magini from Shadowfax and Little Feet playing bass for us on that. And I'm very glad that music is coming back into my life in a big way. That was me.
Good. You sound like Marty Bell in the Jefferson Airplane. 1967. It actually had a very much of a 1967 Jefferson Airplane kind of sound to it.
There's been a lot of great influence, and I'm just so blessed that lately my life is filling up with musicians.
Mine is too. You know, it's a very strange coincidence. When I moved out here, I started playing with the Tune Jam over at the in Cambridge, New York, next door, about 8 miles away from where I am. And you know, we play Appalachian old time fiddle tunes with a very strange ensemble that includes a trombone on bass.
I love it.
And about three fiddles, a couple of flutes, a harp, a piano, and a couple of mandolins, and a guitar.
What would we do without this art and this creativity to balance the shit that's out there?
Well, it helps, that's for sure.
It certainly does. Anyway, that was New White Trash. If you like the song, you can find us at newwhitetrash.com. We're on the Lifeboat Hour tonight with our guest James Howard Kunstler, my good friend and author. We've got a few minutes left before the station break. You know, I was thinking during this week that as I was looking back and, you know, taking a walk down memory lane with you, because just think about how much, Jim, the world has changed in the 2 years since you and I were involved in that History Channel Prophets of Doom 2-hour show.
I mean, I wonder what happened to old Hugo. I wrote about him in this book, Too Much Magic.
We kind of blew that poor guy's mind.
He did seem a little shaken when he left. This was a guy who was a computer, artificial intelligence dude. I think he was an Australian national who was working in China and had been working there for a long time. And he was very alarmed because he had discovered that the work being done in artificial intelligence convinced him that the computers were going to turn around and try to exterminate the human race.
we're doing a fine job by ourselves, but okay, go ahead.
Yeah, well, that's true. But, you know, we put a couple of questions to him that seemed to shake his worldview quite a bit. The first one was, where are the computers going to plug themselves into?
Yes.
And he literally said, oh, gee, I've never thought of that.
So you saw the spring fly out of his ear, yeah.
Yeah, it was very interesting. And the second one was like, you know, why are you still working with those people if you think they're so evil? And I don't remember what his answer was to that.
Well, he and I were staying at the same hotel, and we had to hold his hand for a while. It's okay. Here's a copy of my book, Confronting Collapse. Here, you want some water? I mean, he was like, and that was the last I saw of him. So, but you know, what else do we expect when people? And he's just an example. We shouldn't pick on him too much. When people who have been in pathological denial suddenly come out of denial. I mean, what do we expect them to do?
I don't know. Jump up and down and go, woo, woo, woo.
Yeah. Or something. We are coming up on a break here in just a minute. Something else that was on my mind this week was that you and I were in what I think is one of the seminal films about this whole situation called The End of Suburbia. My friend Barry Silverthorne. I did that, and you and I were in that together with Matt Simmons. And knowing that I was having you on this week, I really started missing him a lot.
Ah, yeah. And you know, it's kind of funny. It's a little hard to figure out what's going on the oil scene out there because, well, it's not that you can't figure out what the numbers are. I mean, they're there. You can get the numbers. But the kind of delusional thinking that has now become mainstream is just pretty amazing. You know, to see stories in the New York Times which say, in effect, you know, America will soon be energy independent.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Yeah. Are you still there? My line has just gone dead. I'm going to check with the studio in New York. I don't hear Jim anymore. I wonder if the station has me. Let me check in with the board, because I do not know if I am live or not. right now, and I seem to have lost Jim. Right in mid-sentence, too. Station's writing me back. Lost Jim, go to break. We can do that. It actually just happens to be perfect time for the station break at the bottom of the hour. After we come back, we'll take your calls. Lifeboat Hour on PRN FM.
They'll make you feel better. Wash them down with Kool-Aid. It really doesn't matter. When you're feeling down, hello, we've got toys for your mind. Red, white, and blue, yellow. Take two of these, and in no time at all, you'll be fine.
Take these,
no time at all, you'll be fine.
Progressive Radio Network is now on iTunes. Search for us to listen and download past shows or get them updated automatically. Just type Progressive Radio Network in the search bar and download any show free of charge. Progressive Radio Network, information for the independent mind.
Oh, Jeff.
Yes, Lee?
I just want you to know.
What?
You occupy my heart.
Aw.
Cheater on the Rude with Jeff Chrysler
and Lee Papa. Thursdays, 8 p.m. Eastern. Check out our old shows on the archives.
Archives? That sounds like some weird yellow moldy paper stuff.
And you can listen to all of our old moldy shows at PRN.FM.
Did you hear the Progressive Radio Network has a new slogan?
It does.
It does. Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you are coming with us.
That sounds sort of progressive.
It does, it does, but I think it needs to be a little more demanding.
Progressive Radio Network is moving forward,
and we want you
to
come
with us.
I'm Celia Farber. I'm hosting a new show here on PRN called Radio Free Science. We're going to expose the money, the madness, the vendettas, the organized crime, and bring you the heroes, the whistleblowers, the unheard voices who will bring us the truth on the forefront of the battle to free science. Radio Free Science will air every Friday here at PRN at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Hello, this is Richard Martin to remind you that I'll be looking out for you on Mondays and Fridays at 10 a.m. Eastern Time to give you the latest from the financial world and to let you know just how bad things are getting. I'll be telling you things you'll never get to hear in the mainstream media. So join me here on the Wake Up Call. You can listen to the show at any time from the archives, and if you like the show, rate us on iTunes. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
You're listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Take these, you'll be fine. Take these.
Yeah, just take these and then watch and see how long it is before what you've been taking shows up as a commercial for some law firm saying, if you've been taking, but that's the way everything seems to be working now. We are back. The technical difficulties have been resolved. That was a minor hiccup. Welcome back to the Lifeboat Hour, July 1st, 2012. Our guest is Jim Kunstler, my good friend and author and longtime compañero on the struggle to get people's attention and make them realize that there's some things that need attending right now. So, Jim, we're back. We have a caller on the line. I haven't put that out yet. If you want to call in and ask Jim Kunstler a question tonight, call in at 888-874-4888, or you can email me directly at lifeboathour@collapsenet.com. Josh from Connecticut.
Did we cut out? Oh, sad face. Yo.
What's going on at the moment. I have to be very honest with you. I don't even know if I'm coming out live over the air. I've got no response from the studio. Oh, I'm back. Okay, we are back. Okay, that was another interesting one. Now, let's find out if our guest, Jim Kunstler, is back with us. Jim, are you there? We don't have Jim.
I'm here.
Oh, yay!
My call was dropped, and when you switched on to the caller, I got switched off.
Well, that shouldn't be. Now, I don't know if we still have a caller on the line. Josh, are you there? Okay, we did have a caller named Josh. I don't know. Josh, you might try back again. But we're back with James Howard Kunstler.
What did he ask?
Now this is turning out to be a test to see which can persist longer, technical difficulties or our will to face them. That's kind of like what Jim Kunstler has been talking about. Jim, hey, we have Jim, too. All right, Jim, just start talking while I got you before something else goes on.
Well, this is a very interesting illustration of something. You know, we spent about 30 years and about $30 million computerizing the American phone system. And the idea was to improve communication. And now, after all that effort and expense and money spent, it's almost impossible to get a live human being on the phone in America.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody is, you know, sitting around the dinner table getting called by robots.
My very clear perception, Jim, is that the psychological disconnects are becoming more profound, more pronounced, more obvious and more disconcerting by the day.
How did you ever survive in Los Angeles?
Oh, that's easy. I kept closely to Culver City and Venice, stayed, you know, in a very small region. But that was also home. That was also where I was. I was raised in a great many places, but that's where I did my last 2 years of high school, 4 years at UCLA, and became a cop. So it was comfortable and familiar. I could sleepwalk through it. But I have to tell you, since I have been on the land, it has been probably the best thing that's ever happened to me in my life, aside from my dog Rags. Have you ever lived
outside of a big city before?
Oh, sure. I moved 14 times through 7 states before I was 17 years old. Dad was Air Force and government, and so we were out in the boonies in Presque Isle, Maine, and we lived in a rural area outside of Denver, the far borders of Littleton, which in the mid '60s was country.
Oh, really? No kidding.
Yeah,
I've been there. It's like Long Island now.
Yeah, well,
Hackensack.
Yeah, of course.
Presque Isle, Maine. Where the heck is that? What's that near?
It's way up north. It's on the northwest the northwest corner, right near the Canadian border.
Wow,
a lot of
that's remote.
Yeah, it was. I was a little baby then. That was during the Korean War. My dad was an aviator, flying as intercept officer as radar intercept officer in interceptors, waiting for the Russians to come over the pole.
Oh, my gosh.
And Dad told some amazing stories about things he had seen while flying up over the pole.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah.
You mean like strange things?
Actual, real, honest-to-God, unidentified flying objects that couldn't be touched, that made an absolute mockery of anything the Air Force had in the air then. And also wonderful things like flying inside the Northern Lights, which I got the privilege of doing once. So I don't know how we got on that, but we were on the basic idea of getting away from big city, but reconnecting with the land, which has been a dominant theme for those we have shared this movement with, like post-carbon, like transition movement. If you look back on your career over the the last 10 years, and your efforts in this field to wake people up, what would you say your biggest takeaways and achievements were out of that?
Well, you know, I don't think it was really just me. I think that when I published The Long Emergency, that was the same year that several people published books about the same set of subjects. You did with the Rubicon book,
right?
And Heinberg did, and what was the name of the guy at USC? He was a physics professor. Goodstein published a book about oil predicament.
Yeah. Caltech, actually.
Yeah,
he was the vice chancellor of Caltech, yeah.
And I think, towards the end of that year, Matt Simmons published Twilight in the Desert.
Mm-hmm.
So, what you really were beginning to see was kind of a convergence of opinion, that was pretty...
Whoop.
Hello, you there?
I'm still here.
Pretty broad. And it wasn't just me. It was hardly me. The thing that I brought to it was that I was more a professional polemical writer than a scientist or a statistician I was deliberately writing, books that were supposed to be funny.
But you were also a masterful dot connector. In that you laid out the ipso facto, if this, then that kind of scenarios in a way that penetrated, I think. I mean, that's the way I've read you.
Well, thank you very much. It's a compliment. I think we all brought some strengths to making collectively an argument that our culture would be better off if it paid attention to reality.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose the question since then is, has our culture paid better attention to reality? And I think clearly the answer is no. We're now basically running a campaign to sustain the unsustainable. That's been the main business of America for the last 7 years. We are putting enormous amounts of effort into blowing green smoke up our ass collectively, you know, trying to convince ourselves that we're morally upright people for buying Priuses. The quality of the discussion is uniformly lame. You know, I just came back for the third time from the Aspen Environment Forum.
Oh dear.
And yeah,
scary.
You know, it's a very dispiriting thing because you get some of the world's leading science dudes and leading global warming, climate change experts and environmentalists of one kind or another, and all the guys from National Geographic. And, you know, you get them into a room to discuss the resource predicament, and all they really want to talk about is how you can run a car by other means, you know. That we'll all be driving electric cars soon, and it'll be all right. So, you know, even at that level, they don't really want to think about changing behavior. And for me, it's dispiriting because I think the whole issue is going to be, you know, we are going to have to live differently, whether we like it or not. Can we please begin to talk about that instead of just trying to defend the stuff that we've already assembled?
It is so abundantly clear to me that mainstream science has become a moribund religion as opposed to anything else. And there have been such amazing revelations in science lately that are really starting to have some ripples, particularly in quantum physics. People like Michio Kaku, a great many particle physicists are just turning everything we've held on its head, but especially in science now, Darwin is being massacred, has been massacred left and right. He got it wrong. This is not about the survival of the fittest. He made some serious mistakes, and especially in his conclusions, it's been shown that there's a 1.5 million-year gap with respect to the jaw bones and the ankle bones between our closest ape relatives. And how our jaws and ankles got to be the way they are. So science itself, much like the world that it enforces, and I'm talking about the religion of science as a business, Jim. It's dead. It's like that's what I'm seeing.
Well, you're describing an interesting thing, which I try to address in my World Made by Hand novels, which is not, you know, I do think that there is such a thing as kind of fundamental reality, and there is such a thing as fundamental science that accompanies it, in the sense that, you know, certain things are for real and certain things aren't. But what I do think is that the dislocations and discontinuities of the period we're in mm-hmm. are going to leave people very demoralized and discouraged about science and truth, and I think is going to propel us into a new age of superstition. And I tried to illustrate that in the World Made by Hand novels by setting up a conflict between a group of religious cultists and the regular townspeople. And the cultists had moved into the town from Dixieland. They'd been sort of trying to escape the disorders of the southern states in this novel mm-hmm. and move north to find a more tranquil place to live. And they end up in the little town that is the setting of my novel, and they buy the high school, which is no longer being used, and they move in. And they use that as their headquarters. But these people are kind of strangely superstitious and appear to have some strange supernatural powers. But the townspeople at the same time are deeply discouraged and demoralized. You know, science has let them down, technology has let them down. You know, they're no longer, the electricity's off, they're no longer living in a highly complex technological world. They're back into sort of like an 18th century farming economy. And they're very demoralized about that experience. And I think we're going to see that people are going to more and more just discount science, whether it's truthful or not, because they will feel let down by it.
I wrote an essay on Collapse Net 2 years ago now, that was called God on the Table. And in the movie, I made the very clear statement that everything is on the table now. At the start of the show, Gary Null was talking about how all of the mainstream media's numbers are just imploding because all they're offering is babble. It's not making sense. We talk about how science is not making sense, and I'm absolutely certain that every major religion is going to be turned on its head in very short order. Now, there's something else aside from superstition, which is an area that we've discussed frequently on the show with people like Carolyn Baker, about spirituality. And I've taken a strong position on that. Do you think that's a factor in what's going on? Do you think it will play a role? It can be. It can help people adjust.
Well, I am personally kind of not really a very religious person, but I do think that there is such a thing as the sacred, and the sacred as distinct from the profane. And by that, I'm not talking about vulgar language. Talking about, you know, the real fundamental nature of things. And what we've managed to, you know, one of the big diminishing returns of technology in this, you know, last 100 years especially, is that it's managed to extirpate the sacred from most of life.
Yes.
And leave us only with the profane. And you know, as somebody who's not a particularly religious person, I still feel that it's created a tremendous hole in the human condition and in our culture and our daily experience.
I gave a speech in Grass Valley, Northern California, May a year ago. Dmitry Orlov was there. We were together on the same program. And in that speech, I referred deeply to the word sacred because my position has been that in terms of survival and our relationship with Mother Earth and this planet, which is we get everything from her. It doesn't come from any. Our atoms come from her. Our food, everything comes from her. What was not needed for us was to learn something new, but rather to remember a way of life that worked for our ancestors for 40,000 years.
Yeah.
And in that context, what I said was the sacred were the rules that allowed you to stay alive and that allowed you to live in balance. Thou shalt not put your hand in the fire. You know,
yeah.
Thou shalt not defecate on your food and eat it. You know, some things are sacred because they are true, and our ancestors lived in a direct relationship without a book, without a written word, without anything else. It was a conscious, open, living.
Well, I think that's also why there's a very fundamental relationship between what is true art and what is truthful, and that, you know, the best of world art is art that reflects something truthful about our humanness. But what we've been left with in our time is nothing but, you know, shopping and advertising.
Well, okay, that was a great word, our humanness. That is really what's kind of being destroyed along with the climate and the environment and the economy and everything else, is our humanness.
I know. I mean, it's like, you know, here we are destroying the only planet that has been our home, and we're sort of left with the Kardashians.
Well, that's if one assumes that what we're left with is what is represented as being left to us by, again, that mainstream media. And so I'm coming back to, but hey, nobody's listening to them anymore, or not nobody, but their numbers are falling. You know what I'm saying? And that people are listening, I would think, to something else. And I'm sensing that there are good signs of an awakening taking place at least where I run. And I just could be blessed where I am.
Well, that may be so. I tend to put it slightly differently, that you know, what we're seeing in our country right now is just an inability to construct a coherent consensus about what's happening. And the collapse of the mainstream media, you know, is the collapse of that failure. Now, what it will resolve into is another matter. I'm personally a little bit frightened by religious extremism, even though I do think that a sense of the sacred is terribly important.
This is a very interesting epistemological issue because I have never had it happen where I have broached the subject that I call spirituality and had people come back with the word religion, when in fact those of us who live a spiritual life and follow the kind of traditions that I follow, we absolutely shudder at the thought of calling ourselves a religion for the exact same reasons.
Yeah. So, but there are an awful lot of there are an awful lot of doctrinaire religious people out there who would dispute that and start a fight about it.
Yeah, yeah.
And of course that's you know another long story of American history, which is these doctrinaire battles of
I think you're absolutely right on the money to call it the sacred. That's what's important. Because objectively, in the three-dimensional world, if we look at a world that decision makers are trying first to analyze in terms of ones and zeros, which throws out most of the bathwater and half the baby, and trying to fix with those same ones and zeros, they're not capable of either comprehending or solving the problem.
Well, you're raising an interesting issue that has been kind of on my mind a lot lately, which is this idea that it's the statistical analysis issue, the econometric issue, and what it comes down to is a delusion that just because we can measure stuff, we can control it.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the big disappointments, I think, that people are going to feel about science and technology, because they're fed this constant diet of statistical analysis and numbers about, how many people do this and how many people do that and how many gallons and barrels and, what they're going to realize is that none of that quantification is leading to any kind of resolution of these very real problems.
Yeah, I spent 21 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, and over the last weeks on this show, I've been running a theme. We're going to come back to it in future shows. But Alcoholics Anonymous is, and the 12 steps are predicated on the person afflicted with the disease has a progressive disease that gets worse, never better, and that by their own means, their own willpower, by any science, any form of self-knowledge, there is no available solution that will keep them from meeting that fate, and that the only solution is spiritual as opposed to religious, because in AA, everybody gets their own conception of God. It's nobody else's business.
Mm-hmm.
But drawing that analogy to the human race as a whole, we are a race of addicts. We're addicted to oil, energy consumption, and we are repeating the same behavior over and over again, expecting different results.
Mm-hmm. And we're not resolving it very successfully.
No. So therefore, and again, this comes back to what I was talking about in the movie, Jim Kunstler, was that... the only thing that can save us now is a radical and sudden spontaneous change of consciousness. The only thing that we really have to change anywhere right now is what's inside our minds.
Mm-hmm. And I think that that's possible, although it may be less, less sort of flamboyant manifestation than perhaps you're expecting. I mean, I felt... having lived through the so-called Aquarian Revolution, the hippie revolution in the 60s, I'm a little bit older than you, not a whole lot, but a little bit.
3 years, I think.
And, having witnessed that, you see a culture really go through a very, very radical change in temperament. And, I do think that those guys who wrote the Fourth Turning book, William Strauss and Neil Howe, or is it Neil Howe and William Strauss? I don't remember. But, they captured something about the temperament of a period in history and the temperament of generations and how vastly different they can be. Now I was in my pickup truck driving south from Lake George, New York today, and I was listening to some tunes on the iPod. They were English country dance tunes from the 17th century.
Mm.
And just, the incredible elegance and beautiful temperament of that music provoked you to think how much different the entire worldview was of the people living in that period.
Yes.
And how absolutely unimaginable the total impact of that different culture would be on a contemporary mind. And so I think that there's enormous room for culture to change and transform itself in some good ways and in some bad ways. And I think that those transformations will occur. And they might not even be mind-blowing.
Yeah,
they're
fading us out early. I thought we were going to have a couple of minutes over. I apologize, James Howard Kunstler.
Thanks
so much for being on the Lifeboat Hour. We'll get our stuff together and be back with you next week. Got some good surprises and new stuff. See you next
week.
Bye, Mike. Bye, Jim.